Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galev. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today's episode was inspired by an experience which I think a lot of us in the skeptic movement are involved in some regard with the skeptic movement have had. I know I certainly have, our producer has, I'm curious if you have, in which the issue of skepticism comes up, and So you bring up the skeptic movement or you bring up skepticism, and people interpret it, people who haven't heard of the skeptic movement, they interpret it usually in one of two ways. Either they think that being a skeptic just means you're a cynic, so you like debunking things and disbelieving things, or they have heard of skepticism sort of in this classical, like philosophical context, and they think that it means believing that there's no possibility of knowing anything for sure. And so we wanted to talk today about this sort of classical skepticism and what it is, what the arguments are for and against it, and also the degree to which it is actually underlying the sort of modern day scientific skepticism that, you know, the skeptic movement practices.
Right. I do have an instance in which this came up in a kind of a funny way. So this was years ago when I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and on behalf of the local skeptic group, I invited Michael Shermer to give a talk. He had a new book out, and as part of the sort of the event, we also both of us were guests on a local talk radio show. And the host was, you know, very gracious, very nice. He talked to us before the show, and then he started the show. And the first thing he says was, "Well, I'm really surprised and I'm astounded. I've been talking to two skeptics here, and they both seem very jovial, very, very convivial people. And, you know, they were laughing all the time.
So this is sort of the third one. They think skeptic means depressed.
Exactly. It's like, what were you thinking? What did you expect out of this thing?
Maybe he expected that he would say, "It's a nice day," and you'd be like, "I doubt that.
I doubt that." Like, that's right.
That's probably.
Of course, to be honest, my laptop does have that little Skeptical Inquirer bumper sticker on top of it that says, "I doubt it."
I dread ever telling you know, civilians that I'm going to like a skeptic conference or skeptic event, because the first thing they always say is, "I doubt that."
Exactly.
They always think that they're the only person who's ever come up with anything that clever. Anyway.
Isn't humanity beautiful? Okay.
Right, but so the other misunderstanding of skepticism is this classical sort of philosophical skepticism. Right. Maybe it would be good for you to explain
Yes.
history of philosophical skepticism.
Let's start getting
ten
first
words
into,
or less.
In no. 10 minutes or less, yes. Oh, 10 words
ten
or
words.
Less. Are you kidding me? So let's start with the classical stuff, and then I guess we'll make our way to more current and more pertinent things. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's interesting you mentioned cynicism. Mm-hmm. Of course, the word cynic also today means something completely different from what it originally
That's true.
Meant.
It's ironic.
So I think we should start there very briefly. The cynics were actually ancient Greek philosophers. The whole thing, I think, was studied by one of Socrates' pupils. So we're talking about the, you know, 5th century BC, more or less. Now, the word cynic originally means dog.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because the cynics made a habit of being unconventional. One of their unconventionalities was that they chose to live in the streets with no possessions. And so they were living like dogs. So their critics started referring to them as dogs because they were living that kind of life. Now, the most famous one was Diogenes, who famously spent most of his life in a bathtub, apparently. And one of these episodes, one of my favorite episodes of philosophical lore is that apparently Alexander the Great, that Alexander, met Diogenes at one point, and he was impressed by the philosopher's, you know, wisdom and all that. And so basically Alexander said, you know, "Ask anything and I'll give it to you because I'm Alexander the Great, and I can give you the stuff." And Diogenes
called himself that would be cool.
Yeah, that would have been really interesting. And Diogenes' response was, "Well, then could you please move away because you're blocking the sun?"
Wow.
That's all he wanted from Alexander. So anyway, but we're we're not concerned really with the cynics, because in fact, the cynics had nothing to do with the skeptical position of any sort, classical or modern, because the cynics were really people who simply said that the purpose of life is to live according to nature, virtue and nature, that human beings are happy only when they live in a natural play, in a natural way, and that most human unhappiness is the result of, you know, mistaken ideas about what's worth your interest. So going after fame, money, and glory, and all that sort of stuff, it's bad idea, causes pain, it's not conducive to happiness. The only thing that makes people happy is to live simply in a sort of a natural way. So that was the cynics' perspective. By the way, they were very influential for a long time. They actually became very popular during the Roman Empire. And in fact, although they sort of disappeared basically by the late 5th century, their influence continued in ascetic forms of Christianity. Mm. So the Christians themselves got this idea of asceticism from the cynics, apparently.
It's ironic, because the cynics were advocating asceticism because they thought it would make us happiest, which is not the reason the Christians were advocating asceticism.
That is correct.
But anyway,
so that closes, I think, the book on cynics for now. We don't really need to get any further than that. Now, here's the interesting thing about skepticism. We need, first of all, to distinguish what it's referred to as philosophical skepticism from what it's, for lack of a better word, ordinary, normal incredulity. So a skeptic, in the philosophical sense, is not somebody who says, I doubt it. Mm-hmm. It's not somebody who questions a particular belief. Mm-hmm. He questions the ability to have any belief. So it's sort of
across, right?
That's right. Any justified belief, any knowledge. So it's across the board.
Right. So I guess what we in the skeptic movement practice is sort of I've read an expression, methodological skepticism,
yeah,
which
I
think actually describes what we do quite well,
of
sort of suspending judgment about particular issues until, you know, the preponderance of evidence sort of weighs in on
one side. I found actually a reference to, of all people, Wittgenstein, who weighed into this thing. And Wittgenstein said something on the lines of, you know, when you doubt, the doubt has to be within a context that is not itself doubted. In other words, you have to take certain things for granted or assumed or agreed upon or whatever it is, and then you can raise doubts. And that's what modern skeptics do. That's what the skeptical movement does. You know, you take certain things like
the existence of an external world.
Precisely. Or the methods of science, or, you know, epistemology or logic, whatever it is. You take all of those for granted, perhaps provisionally, but nonetheless, you take him for granted. And then you say, okay, given that, let's talk about, you know, parapsychology, for instance, or let's talk about global warming, or whatever it is that it is at issue at the moment. So in other words, for Wittgenstein, you cannot do skepticism in the ordinary sense of the term unless you actually do assume quite a bit about, you know, fixed and they're not skeptical about it.
Right. So philosophical skepticism is calling into question those premises?
That's right. So the philosophical skeptic is actually somebody who questions the entirety of a member, all the members of a class of propositions. For instance, propositions, epistemic propositions about the world. Mm-hmm. It's important to understand that there is actually within philosophical skepticism, there is a distinction between two types which are often confused. One is called academic skepticism, and the other one is called Pyrrhism. Pyrrhism refers to Pyrrho, who was a philosopher who lived in the 3rd century BCE, between the 3rd and 4th century BCE. And I'll get in a minute to what he was saying. And then academic skepticism refers to the academy, as in Plato's academy, because some of the philosophers that espoused that form of skepticism were Plato's disciples. Not Plato himself, but some of Plato's disciples. Now, most of the time, when we talk about philosophical skepticism, we really refer to academic skepticism. And the quintessential example of academic skepticism is Descartes' approach.
Descartes.
Mm-hmm. So Descartes and his radical doubt is the quintessential example of academic skepticism in philosophy. So as is well known, you know, Descartes started out with his thought experiment. He said he wanted to establish knowledge on a firm foundation. And so he did this thought experiment in which he said, well, look, can I rely on my senses? And his answer was, well, no, not really, because my senses sometimes deceive me. You know, I have hallucinations, or I can have a dream or whatever. So I can't rely on my senses. Well, can I rely on reason, therefore? Well, no, because there too I can be mistaken. I mean, there may be things that I perceive clearly and like, for instance, mathematical proofs, but I could be mistaken. It turns out that sometimes I make a mistake when I do math, and so I can't rely on that either. And so he kept going and pushing the boundary of what he could possibly rely on. And he finally arrived at the fairly radical conclusion. Oh, he said, you know, can I be mistaken about the world itself? And in fact, can I be even mistaken about the fact that I'm a physical being in the world? Mm-hmm. It seems like that would be difficult to do. But he said, I can imagine a sort of an evil demon that is out there deceitfully trying to be deceitful about everything and to bring me to the wrong conclusion of everything. And in fact, I cannot really be sure to be a physical being, because after all, there are states of my mind, for instance, when I'm dreaming, where I'm not actually inhabiting. It looks like, it feels to me like I have a physical body, but I'm not. I don't. I'm dreaming. Once you start doing that, going down to that path, the cart eventually stopped at the famous cogito, the cogito ergo sum, Latin for I think, therefore I am, mm-hmm. right? So he said, look, the only thing I cannot possibly doubt, no matter how many evil demons are trying to deceive me, no matter how much I don't want to rely on reason and how much I don't want to rely on empirical evidence, the only thing I cannot possibly be mistaken is the fact that I am an individual, and the reason that I cannot be mistaken about that is because I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. There cannot be a me without thinking. That was his idea, right? From that perspective, then he started to go back, and we may be able to explore this a little later.
Yeah, I'm curious how he built up his view of the world without using reason, but.
Yes, so we can get to that, but let me first summarize the Pyrrhonism and that we get rid of that, and then we can go back to Descartes. Okay, so that was Descartes' project. That is, in fact, academic skepticism. Okay. Pyrrhonism is a really interesting position, which is often misunderstood. Basically, that is the position that Pyrrhonists thought that there really is no particular reason to assent to any proposition or anything that is not self-evident, not even the position of the skeptics. When the skeptics tell you that you can't trust the senses or you can't trust reason, for the Pyrrhonists, they don't have evidence for that either. They don't have sufficient evidence for that either.
They're not sure that they're not sure about.
That's right. It's okay. Sort of a meta skepticism, right?
I feel like if you add enough of those layers of skepticism on top of each other, they just start canceling each other out like rows of Tetris blocks.
That would be nice. But, I mean, if you think about it, it's an interesting position, because the Pyrrhonists really actually did go on and suggest that people follow their, live their lives as, according to what their perceptions were and according to what their reasoning was. It's just that they said, you cannot possibly be sure of anything. So don't stake your life on a particular notion, because you have no particular reason to think that the notion is correct or incorrect. You will have to take a position for pragmatic reasons, for practical reasons, but there is no theoretical foundations according to which you can actually claim, okay, I have perfect, complete, solid knowledge of anything at all. So in some sense...
So it sounds like it's academic skepticism plus the addendum that, well, but it doesn't matter, just ignore it.
No, it's even more than that. It's skepticism about academic skepticism. It is the position that you cannot really be sure of anything, even of the fact that you cannot actually rely on whatever it is that the skeptics are criticizing.
No, but this is what I'm saying, that these things cancel out. That if you can't be sure of whether you can be sure of something, then you can't be sure of that thing.
But that, if you think about it, that for the time was a fairly radical position. Right, because today we're used to say things like, "Well, scientific knowledge, for instance, is provisional," right, and we're fine with that. Well, at least most of us are fine with that. We are fine with saying that human knowledge is provisional. We're okay with epistemological theories and psychological evidence that tell us that humans are fallible, and so whenever you think that you know something for sure, there is in fact the chance that you may be wrong. Mm-hmm. The Pyrrhonists got there very, very early and basically undermined what what is known in philosophy as the rationalist program. The rationalist program, Descartes was the last greatest rationalist. And the rationalist program started at the very least with Plato, so it has a long history. And that is the idea that you can derive positive, absolute, certain knowledge from just thinking about things, mm-hmm. from using logic. It also undermines the other major program in philosophy, the empiricist program, the idea that ultimately all knowledge comes from the senses. Mm-hmm. The empiricist said, we don't know. We have really no particular reason to go one way or the other. So all knowledge, it turns out to be fallible. All knowledge turns out to be something that you cannot actually rely on because there is no ultimate foundation for knowledge. I think that's actually a fairly sophisticated position. I mean, we only have arrived at that position again in epistemology very recently. We just had an episode with Rebecca Goldstein when we talk about Kurt Gödel and his incompleteness theorem. The purists would probably be very happy with something like Gödel's theorem because it's one more piece of evidence that there really is no way to be sure about, in that case, about mathematical knowledge. But the purists would say everything. So they're very radical. Now, very few philosophers today, of course, spend any time on purism.
Well, if they did, they wouldn't really be philosophers, right? Because there's nowhere you can go from
That's
from
nowhere.
There,
it's so. Exactly right. There's nowhere you can go from there. And so we sort of set it aside. And I guess we should go back to Descartes. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. No, I'd love to hear your explanation of how Descartes got from I am thinking to, you know, he built up a pretty complex picture of how the world worked. So
I'm afraid
I should say that what I would actually go one step before Descartes' step and say
sure.
There is thinking occurring, not I am thinking, because I feel like using
right.
the I is already assuming too much about, you know, the
that is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. And of course that's also congruent with some modern neurobiology, you know, all the research on split brains, for instance.
Right, exactly.
Showing that this I idea it's a little fishy.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, Descartes was writing at the time of Galileo, was, you know, early 17th century. He did not have the luxury of neurobiology on his back.
Sure, sure.
But
okay,
so
let that one slide.
Yes, in fact, perhaps probably Descartes would be perfectly happy with that notion as well.
Okay.
I think
it doesn't ruin what he built up. All right. So
what was
the next step?
It doesn't ruin his radical skepticism. It does. There is no reason to go that far to ruin the rest of his system because, unfortunately, he got in trouble immediately.
Okay.
So that's why Descartes is often referred to as the last of the rationalists in philosophy, because he basically, sort of somewhat ironically, demonstrated once and for all that the rationalist program was not going to go anywhere.
And
unintentionally.
Right.
And the reason for that is because, of course, once he got to his radical doubt, and he said, okay, the only thing I can be sure of is that I think, or as you were putting it, that there is thinking being done mm-hmm. somehow. His idea was to then start from that firm foundation. Because remember, the rationalist program, the idea of the skeptical doubt was, let's go back all the way down to the bottom as slow as we can go, and then we'll rebuild from the bottom up.
Right.
Well, turns out that he immediately realizes that in order to build regular knowledge and scientific knowledge and mathematical knowledge from the bottom up, he needs what he called clear and distinct knowledge or understanding of things. There has to be things that are essentially undoubtful. And the only way he can guarantee that he can have any kind of knowledge that is clear and distinct and undoubtful is if God comes in and says, you are the kind of being that I made that is capable of clear and distinct knowledge. But now you have to bring God in. And how do you know that God exists to begin with? And how do you know that?
How do you know that, according to Descartes?
Well, he has fairly, you know, he makes a lot of mental gymnastics. He engages in a lot of mental gymnastics, which gives rise, by the way, to what people call the Cartesian circle. Essentially, he ends up in circular reasoning. And some people actually think that that is a vicious circle. That is, that Descartes really got himself all tied up in knots as soon as he left the cogito.
So I like Descartes' example of the evil demon as being a possible explanation for why we can't be sure of all the things that we think we know, or the reason that we think is sound. And we should probably at this point go through some of the other skeptical hypotheses that philosophers have formulated over the years to provide sort of possible scenarios for why we could be mistaken about everything that we think is the case. So in addition to the evil demon, There's the dream argument,
right,
that everything is actually just a dream. There's the brain in a vat hypothesis, right, that the external world is just, you know, a simulation produced in our brain, and our brain is actually sitting in a vat somewhere.
Which actually would be compatible with Descartes' extreme version of the therefore I am. That it's just the brain that's thinking.
Yeah, right. So the brain is, yeah, there's thinking going on, exactly. So mm-hmm. that's not wrong. It's just the thing. Well, it's debatable whether the brain is actually wrong about the things that it's thinking. That's kind of an interesting argument.
But about the fact that it is thinking, it's not wrong.
Right. No, that's true.
Right.
The one that I think is really tricky is the hypothesis that you can't actually trust anything. You can't trust your memory of the past. So maybe you were just called into existence a second ago, and everything that you think you experienced, or even the reasoning, the previous steps in reasoning that you just thought of, didn't actually happen.
Right.
So
yeah, you can get as radical as actually seriously doubting that 2 + 2 = 4. Because you can say, well, it seems to me that that is right, but how do I know that I'm not fooling myself into thinking something so bizarre?
Yeah, actually, you know, I think I've just conflated this like 5-minute hypothesis, or I don't know, 5-second hypothesis, with the madness hypothesis. I don't know if that one has a name, but essentially, you know, I agree that you can't technically trust reason because you could just be mad. I mean, you could mm-hmm. just
right.
think that 2 + 2.
I know a couple of people like that.
Yeah, I'm curious to get your take on these various skeptical hypotheses. Do you think any of them can clearly be ruled out? Are they all equally valid hypotheses? Or
it's hard. That's the thing about skepticism, that it's when it gets that radical. When we're talking about philosophical skepticism, it's really hard to imagine how you could possibly rule out any of those things. For instance, let me come up with another example. This is G.E. Moore, who was an influential early 20th mm-hmm. century British philosopher, famously said, you know, that there are certain things you can't doubt, like the fact that I have a hand. Well, as it turns out, you can, because there are brain abnormalities in which people think that they have an arm that they don't have anymore.
Sure.
So there's even that kind of thing. You can think that you have perfect knowledge of your body, that you understand what your body is, because you can feel it. You don't just see it, you feel it. And yet even that feeling can be, in fact, you know, fundamentally wrong. So one can imagine extending that kind of situation to the whole world. And, you know, often people come up with these silly sort of refutations of skepticism. And one of the famous ones was, well, I refute you thus by kicking a stone and, you know, making the movement of touching an object. Well, that doesn't refute anything, because, of course, your imagination could be making up the stone, the feeling of hitting the stone, and so on and so forth. When I tell when I introduce my students in philosophy to the idea of skepticism, I say, you know, it is perfectly possible and conceivable that you guys are all a figment of my imagination. And I tell them, usually somebody at that point says, well, what if I come up and punch you in the nose? And my response is, don't do it. First of all, because you failed the class. Second of all, because...
That's one way to argue.
That's one way to argue, right? It's called argument from authority.
Uh-huh.
And second, I'll punch you back. And third, you simply have not established your point, because, of course, my imagination, the simulation within I am, could, in fact, be making up also the feeling of pain itself. So that's not going to solve anything. So it is really hard to imagine. You know, you can push this as much as you can, as you like. You can push it to the matrix type of scenario, which is essentially an extended brain in the vat sort of scenario.
Yeah, right? Well, there's a difference between the solipsistic brain in a vat scenario, where no one else is really conscious or, you know, existing.
Right.
They're just figments of your imagination or your simulation, or the matrix, in which there are many brains in vats.
That's right.
And
it's a social brain in the vat.
Yeah, that one's less depressing to me.
I mean, slightly.
That one to me actually doesn't feel as much like us being wrong about everything we think we know. It feels more like we're just wrong. We're wrong about what reality is actually made of. So it's made of, you know, computer bits instead of atoms,
right,
or whatever. But that feels like less of an earth-shaking revelation, if such a thing were true.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think a lot of people would be actually quite shaken by that.
No,
but
less compared to the other, like,
possibly.
I'm mad and no one else exists.
Yes, that's that's probably the case. But so some philosophers are actually considering seriously the possibility that the entire universe is being, you know, simulated. There's clearly several science fiction movies have explored that sort of possibility.
Well, you've heard Nick Bostrom's simulation argument,
mm-hmm,
have you?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll give that briefly. The premise is that it's not that unlikely that some future civilization will have the means and the desire to simulate its ancestors, simulate past generations on Earth. And it also seems not that unlikely that if they have the means and the inclination, they would run many, many simulations of past Earth, either for entertainment purposes or just out of interest or for, I don't know, scholarly research purposes or what have you. But the constraint on their ability to simulate past Earth is much lower than the actual sort of physical constraint of a real Earth. I mean, you're limited only by how much computing power you have, really, if you want to simulate past Earths. So the argument then goes, if the simulated Earth feels indistinguishable from within the simulation to how the real Earth feels to the actual people who are living who had lived in the past, then from our perspective, looking around at the Earth around us, we actually have a greater chance of being in one of the simulated Earths than we do of being actual people in the past living on the real Earth, if there are sufficiently more simulated Earths than real Earths.
Right. Now, first of all, I think that there are so many things wrong with that argument that it's not even funny.
It's such an interesting argument.
It is interesting, but it's wow. Well, the first thing is, of course, this is not new. Gene Roddenberry got there first. The holodeck on Star Trek: The Next Generation was exactly that. In fact, there are several episodes where Data and Picard interact with a holographic version of Dr. Moriarty. Sherlock Holmes' arch enemy. And at one point in one of these episodes, Moriarty actually figures out, because he's smart, that he's in fact a simulation. And he starts exploring the possibility of getting out of the holodeck, whether he can survive outside of the holodeck. And in that episode, if I recall correctly, I haven't seen it recently, but if I recall correctly, Data figures out a way to essentially fool Moriarty that he actually has been able to escape, and they build an entire universe for him to explore, the simulated universe, of course, for him to explore and make him happy. So the idea, of course, that it is plausible that we are the result of a simulation. I love it when philosophers and others, because philosophers are not the only culprit on this thing, but when they start an argument by saying, there is no reason to believe that X is not true.
Okay.
Well, since you're making an extraordinary claim, it seems to me that you better ought give us the reasons why we should believe or even entertain that claim, rather than say, well, there is no reason to not to believe it.
Are you talking about one of the
simulation
premises
stuff.
That it's reasonable to believe that a future civilization would have the means and inclination
right.
to...
Why is it exactly reasonable?
No. He was not saying it's likely.
I don't even think it's reasonable. I mean, I didn't say that. But there's a difference between something not being reasonable and something being impossible. Impossible is a high standard.
I was just saying that in his original argument, he doesn't actually assign like a percentage of possibility to it.
I would think not.
No. Saying whatever probability you assign to it, you can sort of roughly calculate then the chance of you being in a simulation.
But that reminds
not.
Me of, similar discussions are often had among philosophers about, and scientists actually, physicists, about time travel. And, you know, there's some ways in which you can get time travel out of physics, so it's not impossible. It is not logically impossible for sure. It's possibly not even physically impossible. And so people start saying, well, so if that is true, somebody eventually would have figured out that how to do it and all that sort of stuff. And of course, the obvious question then to ask is, so where is everybody?
Right?
Yes, exactly. Which is, of course, the same. I mean, I understand we're jumping a little off the main track here, but we'll get back to it. It's a little bit like the famous Fermi paradox concerning SETI,
right?
Where is everybody? The search for extraterrestrial intelligence when Fermi back in the 50s, the SETI stuff was getting off the ground. And apparently over lunch, some of his colleagues were all excited about this thing. And he stopped them that in the track and said, well, if there are so many civilizations around the galaxy, you know, where is everybody? Where are they? And the argument that he was making was that once you develop the technology for even very slow interstellar travel, since given the huge time scales that we're talking about, you know, billions of years on the evolution of the galaxy, there ought to be a galaxy that is populating with this, you know, very, very frequent visits by all sorts of things, and we're not seeing them. So there's got to be a particularly some kind of good reason for it. Now, I'm not suggesting that Fermi was actually correct on that one. I think it wasn't.
We should do a separate episode on that.
But nonetheless, it's interesting when you start an argument with, there is no reason to not entertain this possibility. Okay, that's fine.
That to me is like the least interesting part of the argument, the question of how likely it is that future civilization would have the means to do this. But
the internal structure of the argument,
it's sort of like a pretzel argument. That's what I've found really interesting.
A pretzel in what sense?
Just in the sense that...
pretzels, but of a different kind.
In the sense that your reasoning about the world from within a simulation... Right. You know, you're using the evidence about the world around you in your simulation to reason about the likelihood that you're in a simulation.
Right.
Anyway, but that is a little bit far afield. So
yes. Let's get back on the field.
Yeah. I had wanted to comment on you were talking about how ridiculous it gets very quickly to practice this kind of radical skepticism.
Right.
And I think one of the best examples of that comes from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books. As is often the case, yeah. I think those books are really deceptively deep beneath all that tongue-in-cheek, zany British humor. So, spoiler alert, I suppose, those of you who have not
think
read...
Any serious listeners of this podcast better read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, and if not, they deserve the spoilers. So, the motley crew ends up making it to the domicile of the ruler of the universe, whom they know nothing about, but they're in search of for various reasons. And so they meet him, and he's just this little simpleton living in a shack on his own with just a cat to keep him company. And he is as radical a skeptic as you could ever hope to find. So that's what's sort of so ironic about him, that he doesn't necessarily believe in the existence of the universe that he's actually ruling.
He's actually ruling.
So they ask him his name, and he says, I don't know. Why do you think I ought to have one? It seems odd to give a bundle of vague sensory perceptions a name.
Demonstrating a Humean view of consciousness, a bundle of perceptions.
Sure, yes, exactly. And so they ask him how long he's been ruling the universe, and he says, this is a question about the past, isn't it? How can I tell that the past isn't a fiction designed to account for the discrepancy between my immediate physical sensations and my state of mind? And they ask him, do you answer all questions like this? And he says, I say what it occurs to me to say when I think that I hear people say things. More than that, I cannot say.
That's pretty radical.
Let this be an object lesson to all of you at, you know, what happens when you actually adopt radical skepticism.
That's pretty radical. Now, I wanted to bring up a different point about the connections between modern skepticism and sort of ancient skepticism, which is the word itself. As you know, the word these days, we started out the episode by acknowledging that the word tends to have a fairly negative connotation in popular parlance. In fact, there are some of our skeptical colleagues, including our own producer, who think that we really ought to avoid the word skeptic because it's immediately
problematic.
It is just like atheist. It's a problematic word that the people have.
Atheist, you said? Just like atheist?
Yes, that's right. The people tend to attach a particularly negative connotation to the word. Now, my personal theory is that it doesn't matter what the connotation is, what the word is. If you change the word into something else, eventually people will catch up with the idea that, for instance, secular humanism is the same thing or very similar to atheism, and people will start hating secular humanists together with atheists. So I'm not sure that move makes does much in terms, in practical terms. But the point is, the reason I actually would like to retain the word skeptic is precisely because of its roots. The Greek root for skeptic means to seek, a seeker, to inquire. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what skepticism in the modern sense is. Mm-hmm. It's an inquiry. It's, I don't have certain knowledge, but I'm going to look for the best knowledge that I can get. I'm going to look for, I have an open mind, I maintain a skeptical attitude, meaning that I realize that most of the times we get it wrong. And so I'm skeptical about any new notion until I have sufficient reason to believe it or to accept it provisionally. But it is a quest. It's a positive attitude of research, of inquiry. which I think really should be salvaged from the sort of the general idea of skepticism. This is really what it is about. It's about keeping an open mind, but in a reasonable way. Not an open mind, as Carl Sagan famously put it, not an open mind that is so open that your brain fall off, but you know, an open mind in the best sense of the word, not in the sort of mystical fluffy sense.
Well, so I think that what it really comes down to is whether you think that you can't know anything for sure means you can never have any greater degree of confidence about any one claim than any other claim,
right,
which is sort of the radical skepticism.
Yep.
And if that's what you believe, then there's no point in seeking truth at all, because nothing is any more likely to be true than anything else, and no evidence or reasoning could possibly help you settle these questions. So that's the sort of sterile avenue.
Right.
Versus the skeptical approach where you acknowledge that you can never know anything for sure in the sense of having 100% certainty about anything, but
right,
you can increase your confidence through evidence and through reasoning and through, you know, gradually learning more and seeking. So that's sort of the completely non-sterile skeptic approach. And that's much closer to what we actually do.
Absolutely.
As methodological skeptics.
Absolutely. That's the essence of critical thinking and understood in the modern sense of the word. I want to say, however, going back to the root, to the sort of philosophical roots of it, mm-hmm, you know, often we encounter this idea that, oh, well, look at how silly, say, somebody like Descartes looks like from today's standards, because, you know, he was trying to do this radical doubt thing, and then he ended up having to invoke God, because otherwise he wouldn't get out of the hole that he dug himself into. But if you think about it, the realization that certain foundation for knowledge are not possible, that no kind of knowledge, mathematical or empirical, and therefore that neither the rationalist nor the empiricist program could possibly have succeeded, that is a major advance in philosophy. I mean, one of the reasons we so readily understand and accept today that there is no sense in looking for a basic foundation, you know, a foundational basis for anything, any kind of knowledge, including scientific knowledge, is the result of the fact that these people had tried really hard from Plato to Descartes, and they failed in very imaginative ways. They failed in very interesting ways, and we learned that way. I often make this point that philosophy makes a progress in a somewhat parallel and yet somewhat different way from what science does. Karl Popper famously said that science makes progress by eliminating the wrong hypothesis, that we're never sure that a scientific theory is correct. All we can be sure is that some other scientific theories are wrong. That if you say, for instance, that after the famous eclipse of the sun at the beginning of the 20th century, Einstein's theory was proven to be correct, that is simply not the case. What happened was that Newtonian mechanics proved to be wrong, and Einstein's theory just survived it to fight another day. And one of these days is probably going to be proven wrong, or at least incomplete to some extent. So that's also the way science works. In philosophy, of course, the difference is that, you know, we make progress in the same way, by eliminating bad ideas. But that progress is done through conceptual and logical analysis, not through empirical evidence, because otherwise there would be no difference between science and philosophy. So I do find a lot of value in the struggle of these thinkers that tried really hard, as much as a human being can possibly do, to establish, you know, sure foundations for knowledge, and kept failing, and it kept failing in more and more complex and sophisticated ways, until at some point Kant, who was the philosopher who essentially overcame the dichotomy between rationalists and empiricists, finally Kant realized that, no, you know what, this simply cannot be done. Now we have pretty good reasons to believe that program simply cannot be achieved. There is no sure foundation for knowledge. So philosophy after Kant is very different. But Kant himself famously said that he got his ideas, he was inspired in his ideas by Hume, who was the last, one of the last of the great empiricists. And Kant said, you know, that he was awoken in its slumber by realizing what Hume actually was saying, and he was trying to react to what Hume was saying. So there is some progress that started all the way back to with the purists and with the academic skeptics. Those positions seem silly today, although, interestingly, they're indefeatable. I mean, we cannot actually defeat radical skepticism.
Which position seems
silly? Radical skepticism, yeah. Radical skepticism cannot be defeated. It's simply that, but the lesson you take out of it is not that, therefore, you have no reason to believe that there is an external world. The lesson you take from it should be one of epistemic humble attitude, epistemically humble attitude. In fact, I cannot even prove that there is a world which seems to so evident to me, and it seems to so obvious, and yet, in fact, it is perfectly conceivable and perhaps even likely that we are inside of somebody else's simulation. So that ought to make people a little more humble from an epistemic perspective.
So it's basically just proceeding with philosophy as if we could be certain of the things, like an external world, and that our reason is sound, that we're not mad, and all those sorts of things. But just sort of adding a little asterisk on the end of everything we say that has the addendum, assuming, of course, that there is an external world, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. So it doesn't sound like it actually changes the way we do philosophy, the way we reason about the world, or the way we try to understand the universe. It's just sort of this little asterisk that we don't really do anything with.
Well, that's one way to put it. I think it's a big asterisk, because it's a big asterisk in the sense that, again, it forces you to admit that really, you don't have any particularly strong reason to reject that radical notion. And if you don't, it really does mean that you could be fundamentally mistaken about the structure and the nature of the world. And, you know, most of us don't think of it that way. Most everyday reasoning and most scientific reasoning is done on the assumption that we actually have a pretty damn good understanding of what the world looks like, or what the reality of things actually is.
Don't you think that everyone, even the people who claim that explicitly, if you really ask them, well, are you, wouldn't you admit that it's possible you could be just completely mad? That they would say, yes, well, of course it's possible. That, like, everyone sort of has this asterisk. They just don't think about it that much, or it's not.
We must be hanging around different kinds of people, because I don't actually know a lot of people who would do that.
I figure people just ignore that, because where are you going to go from there? It's not really, it is, as I was saying, a very sterile position, and so we just ignore it. But
maybe, but even
that important.
Even if I grant you that a lot of people that are capable of reflecting on these kinds of things would readily agree with the asterisk, big or small it is, I still maintain that that is because over hundreds of years, we've been exposed to these ideas, and we've begun to accept them as normal. So now it seems like it's trivial that we could
it's
be living
possible.
in a simulation, but it wasn't trivial until very recently.
I guess it's possible.
You know, it's like the same in a completely different area of sort of philosophical thought. We were mentioning earlier, before the show, we were talking about John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, which was published about a little more than 150 years ago, and it's sort of it includes most of the foundations of the structure of modern democracy. And now we take all those foundations for granted. Mill doesn't really sound that radical when he talks about equal rights for men and women. But only 150 years ago, that was a pretty radical thought. And let's not forget that it was not practiced in the United States until less than a century ago. So today it's tempting to think of those things as, little asterisks and little things. Well, yeah, of course, everybody agrees. But in fact, everybody does agree on that, precisely because other people went out there and made that kind of statements that at the time were radical. Mm-hmm.
So I would also like to make sure I get a chance to make the point that what I've noticed, what I think one of the main pitfalls of this kind of, well, we can't know attitude is in practice, is that people apply it selectively to things that they don't want to really evaluate rationally. So, you buy a lottery ticket and someone says, oh, well, the chances of you winning are so low. And you're like, well, you can't know I won't win.
That's true.
That's not a great example, because you find out whether you win or not. And there's sort of like a very clear odds.
The existence of God is an obvious example, right? Well, you cannot, or the existence of UFOs. You cannot prove that there are no flying saucers.
Yeah, okay, so those
saucers,
are probably
right?
better examples that...
Well, I cannot prove it, but, have you got any evidence?
Right. So it's just this excuse not to think probabilistically about the world, not to think in terms of degrees of confidence. How confident should I be in this particular proposition?
Right.
Whereas in the rest of their life, about claims that people don't have this emotional investment in, don't have this need to hold on to the claim, they do sort of just naturally apply this probabilistic thinking.
Right.
What are the chances that I... that the store is going to have the thing that I want. Should I bother going, or should I stay home? You can't know the store won't have it. No, but that doesn't mean you go out if you think that chance is really, really low. We know how to do this. We just don't apply it to everything.
It certainly doesn't. That position is certainly irrational. But that idea that, we can make probabilistic statements about the world, brings us back. I think, you know, we cannot possibly have an episode on skepticism and the history of skepticism without due reference to the father of modern skepticism, and yet an exponent of some degree of philosophical skepticism, and that's David Hume. Hume was interesting for this reason. He was both a radical skeptic in a particular way that I'm going to, you know, summarize in a minute, but he was also arguably one of the first Bayesians, even though he did not know actually of Thomas Bayes' theorem, which was published actually during Hume's lifetime. But Hume did not know about it. Hume was, of course, is most famous in the skeptical circles for the rendition of his thinking that was proposed by Carl Sagan, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. The way Hume put it, it was that, you know, a reasonable person proportions his belief to the evidence. Which is actually like even better, right?
Yeah,
it's even better because it doesn't apply only to extraordinary claims.
Exactly.
It applies to every claim.
Now,
that is the same Hume, however, who also came up with the problem of induction, which essentially is a radical undermining of scientific knowledge. You know, Hume basically said, look, science proceeds by inductive reasoning, which is by generalizations from particular to generals, and the only reason we believe that inductive reasoning works is because it has worked in the past, which is a form of induction. So essentially, the only way we can justify inductive reasoning is by circular reasoning, which is really not good. If you do circular things, circular reasoning in philosophy, you're not doing particularly well. So here we have the same guy, right, who on the one hand potentially undermined the entire structure of science because he actually showed that there is no particular, no rational defense for the basic methods of reasoning that are used in science. And on the other hand, he says, well, a reasonable person proportions his beliefs to the evidence.
Yeah, well,
I think it's actually a profound thing because it's both an acknowledgement that we really have ought to be much more epistemically humble than most of us are, but at the same time that we need to be practical. And then if you live a practical life, you know, you forget about the problem of induction, you forget about the fact that you could be wrong about everything in the world, and what you do is use the best tools you have available, science being one of them, of course, and proportion your beliefs to evidence. I think that embodies to me the best attitude of a skeptic, because it's somebody who is both again, humble, mindful of the limits of human knowledge, mindful of the epistemic limits of humanity, and at the same time, tries to be reasonable and do the best with whatever it is that we have available.
That's nicely put, and I can't top that. So I will wrap up this section of the podcast, and we'll move on to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is an article, and I chose it for this episode in particular because it's quite relevant. I sort of roughly, vaguely alluded to it at some point in the episode without actually mentioning it by name, but it's called The Matrix as Metaphysics by David Chalmers. And I think it originally appeared in a collection of The Matrix and Philosophy in the series of, you know, the X and Philosophy
books.
Yeah,
Philosophy and Pop Culture, right.
Philosophy and Pop Culture books, which, Massimo, I think was one of your picks in an earlier episode. But anyway, the entirety of the paper is actually available online, and we will link to it on the podcast website. But so David Chalmers does what I think is quite a good job of breaking down he talks about the possibility that the world is a simulation, that we're all brains in vats, and he asks, well, how would that mean that we're actually wrong about all of our beliefs about the world? And he breaks down all the different sort of possible scenarios. How wrong would we be if, for example, the simulation were just like if, you know, solipsistically, I were the only brain and all the other brains were simulated, versus if the simulation, if the simulators were actually interfering in the simulation, versus if the simulation actually extended from the beginning of time to the end of time. And so he talks about the implications of all of those different possibilities. Because usually I think people tend to conflate the simulation hypothesis or the very many different simulation hypotheses together. But the implications of them all are very different in terms of how big of a difference it would make. So The Matrix as Metaphysics, David Chalmers.
Sounds good. Now, my pick is a book. It's a very short book, actually, because it was published originally as an essay in 1986, and then was reissued by University Princeton University Press as a book in 2005, I believe. And it is On Bullshit by philosopher Harry Frankfurt.
Yeah.
It's a very short little thing. It took me, you know, I read it on the plane coming back from Dragon Con just the other day, and it took me a couple of hours. So it's a very quick read, and it's an interesting sort of philosophical, conceptual, and etymological analysis of bullshit. And the basic idea that Frankfurt goes after is that there's an important distinction to be made between lying and bullshitting.
Okay.
And he makes an argument that bullshitting is much worse for human civilization than lying.
Wait, how does he define bullshitting?
Well, he goes through several definitions. It's really worth reading the book. But essentially, the major difference is this, that a liar knows that he's lying and, uh-huh. and he's you know, actively trying to deceive you about the truth, which means that in a perverse way, the liar actually is respectful of the truth. It's, you know, he knows the truth and he's trying to hide it from you for whatever the purpose is, right? The bullshitter, on the other hand, doesn't care about truth or non-truth. He will use whatever it's necessary to arrive at his goal. So sometimes he would use a truth, sometimes a lie, sometimes a half-truth. Sometimes he would sort of mingle things and, you know, mix up things and all that. And Frankfurt goes through several examples of this, which make the distinction between
fields?
Everywhere from you know, everyday experience. Yes, politicians. It's the obvious culprit, of course. So it's an interesting analysis. As I said, it's a very quick read. And by the end, I think you will be convinced that bullshit is, in fact, one of the most present and clear dangers that our civilization is facing. So we better ought to do something about it, which, of course, is why we do this show to begin with.
Excellent. That should be one of our sponsors. We're all out of time. So this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.